And you're listening to radio station WBAI in New York. The time is just about, well, 7 o'clock, I would say. And that means it's time for another edition of Off the Hook. Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Rob.
Good evening.
And Kyle.
Hello there, hackers.
And down in Philadelphia, I believe, is Bernie.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
Wow, you've got a commanding voice tonight. And we are on for another 2 hours tonight with, it's another fundraising edition, so... if you want to just get it over with, please dial 516-620-3602. Pledge whatever you can afford to keep this radio station going. It's quite important that you do that. You can ask if there's any off-the-hook premiums when you call up, but mostly it's about pledging and keeping the radio station on the air. And there are all kinds of WBAI items there for the taking at different pledge levels. Again, 516-620-3602.
Or you can go online at give2wbai.org.
That's right. And become a BAI buddy. That means you pay something like $5 a month or $10 a month, and we wind up getting that times 12 in the end, and that really is helpful, and it's not painful at all.
Yeah, it's like a regular deduction so that you can anticipate your pledge every month at like a regular bill or other expense you might have. So it's a great option, great way to go for us, too. So we thank you for all of those contributions.
And we want to thank those people who called last time we were on 2 weeks ago and pledged their support. It really is the only way a show like this, a station like this, can stay on the air. And when possible, we do what we can to thank people as well. I know there are people who have been waiting for premiums in the past. Part of that is our fault. Part of that is the station's fault. We are getting the information slowly but surely. And if you pledge for something, it is our intention that you get what you pledge for, obviously.
And part of that is verifying pledges, verifying the right addresses and names, and synchronizing with the station. So we want to be sure we're sending out the right things, the right people and everything, and everybody's aware of what's coming out. So
yes,
please bear with us.
Yes. And remember, your pledge is what keeps the radio station going. It's been doing that since 1960. 516-620-3602. Hey, Friday is the deadline for speaker submissions at the upcoming 11th Hope Conference. What that means is if you have any intention, any fantasy, glimmer of hope of giving some kind of presentation, engaging in a panel discussion, even a debate, who knows, all sorts of things you can do on stage in front of a lot of people, you have the opportunity to do that at the next Hackers on Planet Earth conference, which is taking place July 22nd through 24th at the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City. Now, what's different about our conference is that we open up the floodgates to all kinds of different people to give presentations, to share their knowledge, to share their mischief, tell stories, formulate ideas, plans, conspiracies, you name it. It's all there. And we do not stand on pretense and say, well, you have to have a particular degree or certification or anything like that. What you have to have is an idea, is something that would be of interest to 1,000 hackers or a couple of thousand hackers. And there are so many people out there with information to share. I know I see it all the time in the magazine, and we've seen it over the years at the conferences. Please don't feel intimidated if you've never spoken before in front of an audience. It can be a bit frightening, but people are open to new ideas. They're open to what you have to say, and I think you'll find once you do that, you'll feel really amazing and empowered. So the deadline to submit your ideas, basically a paragraph or two on what it is you want to talk about and why it's interesting to the hacker world and all that, and something about who you are, that deadline is this Friday, May the 20th. You can go to hope.net. If you want to be fancy about it, go to xi.hope.net. That's for 11. But hope.net is basically the website, and that will give you all the information you need on speakers. Bernie, do you have anything out, Bernie?
Yeah, I just want to say, if they click on the speakers tab, there's a really nice help document. Call it our speaker tips. If you're not really sure how to write a proposal, this explains in really great detail how to write a short, concise, proposal that's more likely to be accepted. And we've gotten quite a few that people haven't followed those guidelines, but it improves your chances of getting your talk approved if you send it, like no attachments, just some text about what you want to do.
Bernie,
some
on
information
that,
about yourself. And
on that subject, Bernie, what would you say are some of the things that people do that get them not considered very much more after they send? There are some doozies. There are some people. Okay, my favorite is people that get the name of the conference wrong. All right. If you basically are telling us how much you want to speak at the conference, and the conference you're referring to is not our conference, we're not likely to look upon that as a good thing. We don't want carbon copies of talks that have been given at other conferences. We've had people submit carbon copies of talks they've given at our own conference, and we don't want that either. We want new material.
No motivational anything?
Yeah, that's another thing. If people say they're motivational speakers, it works. It motivates us to say no, because that's not what hacking is about. We're not about motivational speaking. Rob, do you have anything?
Another one that kind of bugs several people on our staff is when people attach what they're doing as PDFs or doc files or, Lotus Notes files or whatever. You just need to write the text.
DocX files, ODT files.
Yeah.
We even had MP4. I don't know how that worked.
It was fun. But yeah, it's very easy. You just write the text into your email body, and we'll get it. And that makes it easiest on us. That makes it easiest on you. And I think that leads to more happiness all around.
I've heard also being concise helps. If you write a big, long dissertation, chances are the people who are reviewing these aren't going to actually have the time to read through all of that.
Yeah.
So a nice, concise, direct summary of what you're talking
about. We don't need a PowerPoint presentation in your submission. Some people have sent us an entire PowerPoint presentation. No, we don't need, that's overkill. Other times people have sent a single sentence saying, I would like to talk about this subject, and that's it. Now, we need a little bit more detail than that. Somewhere between those two things, in between the full PowerPoint presentation and the sentence, just fill it in a little bit. Don't worry about being the greatest writer on earth. It's not necessary. We've had people whose first language is not even English, and they've given great talks. That's not a problem. Just be sure that you say something about what you want to talk about and a little bit about who you are. There are a couple of – I don't want to spend the whole time talking about all the rejected applications. They are kind of funny. There were a couple, actually, where the entire topic of the talk was two sentences, but the bios of the five presenters took up something like 8 pages. All sorts of certifications and degrees, great lives you people have led. It's amazing. I'm in awe of you. But you know what? You're not going to be speaking at the conference because you didn't tell us what you want to speak about. You told us a lot about your educational background. Great. But this is about a talk, not about, who you are and what you've accomplished, Rob.
Now, we're talking a lot about what not to do, but I'm asked this question a lot, and mm-hmm. especially as we come up on the deadline, this is relevant. People have asked me, should I submit on X, Y, or Z? And the answer is yes. Go ahead and make your submission, because We're all pretty mellow people, I think, outside of these radio station walls, and we will not actually come to your house and bite you if we don't choose your submission. But we would much rather see it than not see it, I think.
And, you know, even if you don't get an acceptance letter, it does not mean that you cannot give your presentation. There's always the option of lightning talks. There's always the option of the unscheduled track. We try to make as many possibilities open to everybody as possible. We try to be positive about the whole thing and not negative.
So, yeah, that's an important thing. Get the ideas on paper or into a document out of your head so that it's portable, so that we can share with each other and try it on, see if it's something that might work. And, yeah, don't go overboard with the bios. Wait till after maybe you've been asked to do a talk, and then we can follow up with the right kind of bio information.
Right, well, give us some bio info,
but a resume
not,
is
yeah,
not
we only your entire life story.
Yeah, or your sure. resume, yeah.
Yeah, anything else, Bernie? We pretty much cover everything?
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of the HOPE conference, I believe, at least for me, is to share information, and not the kind of information you're normally going to be able to find online or in news media. This is people who've actually done some work on some topic or have some really great idea and want to assemble a work group to accomplish some worthy goal, and they have good ways of doing it and how to go about it, but they just want to talk to a bunch of people that might have a similar mindset to solve this problem, or they've already solved the problem, they want to present how they did it. That's what HOPE is all about. And when you get a lot of people in a room that are passionate about a similar topic, all kinds of wonderful things happen, because then they start talking to each other and they start working on things together. I've lost count of the amazing projects that have grown out of HOPE.
Yeah.
And good relationships too between people, great friendships, people even gotten married, meeting each other at HOPE. It's an amazing way of meeting, birds of a feather, really passionately curious people who are interested in topics that might be interesting to the hacker community, and that's a really broad area. Stuff that's of interest to the hacker community, it doesn't necessarily have to be a technical talk. It could be about something just socially relevant in our community. But by all means, if you have any thoughts on this, go to hope.net and click on the speakers tab, and you'll see on how you can submit your ideas. And do it today or tomorrow or Friday at the latest, because that's our kind of our deadline.
Yeah, that, I can't emphasize what Bernie just said enough. And I would also reiterate your point about getting the submission in by the deadline, but also not always having the answer. I mean, it's not about being the expert. You may very well meet other people that know absolutely everything about what you're curious about, and your presentation sparks some other, as we say, hallway conversation after your talk, or maybe you get together with a workshop or a group that's assembling virtually thereafter.
Yeah.
So all kinds of things can happen by sharing it.
Well, that's an important distinction. You don't have to be the world's expert on a subject to give a presentation. What you have to do is be able to provoke discussion, questions, challenges, and that is a success as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you can come with solutions as much as you can come with problems and things you're trying to actually genuinely figure out. That's
mm-hmm.
that's really something you don't want to forget.
Our last conference, our keynote was Edward Snowden. This year, one of our keynotes is Cory Doctorow. We have some amazing people. We've had Steve Wozniak speak and Kevin Mitnick, all kinds of other people, Jello Biafra. And we've also had people who are still in high school, you know, who give very interesting talks and comprehensive discussions about various issues. Hacker World is amazingly big and diverse.
And our audience is really supportive. I would say we have a really good group of attendees and people who will listen,
mm-hmm.
who will listen very, very carefully to what you have to say. To what you're presenting about. So
yeah.
I would say feel a little nervous, but also excited, because there's a lot of support and a lot of good people that will be eager to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, it's a heck of a place and a great environment just for bouncing ideas off of people. And that's the thing about the HOPE crowd, too, is whatever you've come in to present about or to learn about or both, there will be others there who share the interest. And if you're presenting on something and you maybe don't have all the answers, there will be a few people in the audience who very probably are into exploring that with you. And, you know, we've seen groups get together and projects start at HOPE as a result of people chatting at these things. It's a heck of an experience, and presenting, being part of it, is is really it's really something special, and it's something that I really appreciated the first time I submitted a talk and got up on that stage. I hadn't been on a stage before that. Really,
that was your debut?
Yeah, that was my debut, and
wow.
Nowadays I'm on stages all the time and going through various stages. And
interesting. Okay, well, that's a little fun tidbit that I just learned. Again, the deadline for speaker submissions is this Friday. Go to hope.net. Hackers on Planet Earth is what HOPE stands for. Our conference is in July here in New York City, and you indeed could give a presentation as well, but you only have till Friday to do it. And you know what happened today? Very exciting as well. Tickets went out today.
What's that?
HOPE tickets. If you got bought your ticket for HOPE before May 13th, you should have gotten your ticket today via email.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes. Did you not get your ticket, Bernie?
No, I haven't ordered it yet, but I will. I'll get to it. I have to buy a ticket like everybody else. I'll buy a ticket.
It could sell out this year. We have more tickets than ever that have been sold. So
that is possible. And I tried to get in on some of the specials we had, but everybody else is too quick for me. But it's the very first show.
1 second it took. Less than 1 second for, I think, to sell 100
tickets.
It's amazing. Yeah.
I just want to relate something. At the very first HOPE conference, something resonated with me that stayed with me at every subsequent HOPE conference, and this is the 11th one coming up this July.
Yes.
I had been working, for a couple of years on some project, and then I read somebody else who had been going through the same struggles trying to figure out the exact same thing, and it was amazing. It's like, wow, somebody else is working on the same thing too. How did you figure this out? This is how I came up with the answer to this. And you'll do that. You will run into people who are like working on the same lines as something you are, thinking along the same lines. You will meet birds of a feather at HOPE. It's impossible not to meet people who, just you talk to enough people at a HOPE conference, you will find somebody who, like, shares the same passion as you. And you make a lot of good friends and contacts. And, when you get thousands of people at an event with like 100 some speakers over 3 days, good things happen. It's all about information sharing, and that's what our community is all about.
Now, if you want an idea of the kinds of talks that we've given in the past, you can go to archive.hope.net, and all 10 of our previous conferences, I believe, are archived there. You can see for yourself the kind of talks that we've presented over the years. I'd like to do a little test here of us four to see if we get all the names of the conferences right. I'll start with the first one. We'll go clockwise around the room, and Bernie will come right before me, I guess. I'll start with the first conference, which was called HOPE. Well, that's the name we had for it, Hackers on Planet Earth. Now, Kyle, I believe you're next. You know what the second conference was? And also, please state the year. 1994 was the year of the first conference.
Okay.
You look befuddled.
96.
Okay. Already that's not right.
97.
97 is correct, yes.
But Beyond Hope.
Beyond Hope. That's correct. The only HOPE conference, by the way, that did not take place at the Hotel Pennsylvania, took place at the Puck Building downtown, which is no longer the Puck Building.
It's a
sporting goods store.
Yeah.
Now. That's unfortunate, but it happens. Actually, no, they're taking very good care of the building. I have to give them credit
for
that.
The building looks good, yeah.
Rob T. Firefly, do you know what the third conference was and when?
In the mysterious year of 2000. The year of Y2K, we had H2K.
That is correct, 100%. Bernie, I trust you're not accessing any online sources to find out what the name of the conference that followed that one was.
I've been to all these HOPE conferences, so I do remember them pretty well. Following H2K was H2K2, sort of a homage to R2-D2. We called it H2K2, and it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, but what year was it?
Oh, that was 2002, of course.
Okay, very good. Now it's my turn again. 2004 would be the fifth HOPE. The fifth HOPE took place in 2004 at Hotel Pennsylvania. And now, Kyle, it's you again.
Okay, so 4, 5, 6. 2006.
Okay.
This was actually one of my first HOPEs. It was HOPE number 6.
HOPE number 6. Okay,
yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Rob T. Firefly.
Okay, so 2008.
Uh-huh. You guys are doing good, though. You know history better than most people know, like presidents and things.
I know this one.
I might break the combo. Was 2008 the last HOPE?
Are you asking or telling?
I'm guessing.
Well, as long as you say it in a statement, I'll accept it.
No, question.
What is the next HOPE?
You're correct. The last HOPE was 2008.
Right.
It was not the last HOPE, though, and I guess, Bernie, this is your cue.
We thought it might be the last hope because the plans were to destroy their hotel before the conference, and we thought it would be the last hope. But it had this double entendre thing. It was like the last hope for, you know, for the hacker community that we had this conference. But then there was, in 2010, the next hope.
That's correct. The next hope followed the last hope. Confused?
Which is not to be confused with a hope that's coming up soon.
No.
Which is not the next hope. The
yeah.
next hope happened in 2010.
When you name a conference the next hope and then you can never have another one after that that you refer to as the next hope because it just confuses everybody. Okay, so back to 2012, and that would be hope number 9. That was the ninth hope, 2012. And Kyle, I see you're up yet again.
I want to say 2014.
Okay, then say it.
It is 2014, and that's Hope X.
That's correct. And Rusty Firefly, you have the easy task of identifying the one that's coming up now.
Okay, what year is this? Can I check my phone? No. The next, the upcoming Hope in 2016.
Oh, that's a good unused name. We haven't used that one yet. The upcoming Hope.
Yeah, there you go.
The upcoming Hope in 2016 will be Hope 11.
You got it wrong. That's not what it's called. It's called the 11th Hope.
The 11th
Hope. Not Hope 11. After
Damn.
All this, we get it wrong on the conference that's coming up.
That's
I embarrass myself in front
wrong.
Of you guys,
wow.
in front of my colleagues oh. on the 11th Hope,
oh,
in front
okay.
of our listeners.
And
audience.
It'll forever live in history, too, on the archives.
Course.
All right. Hey, we have a special guest with us who is going to be involved in one of the upcoming talks at Hope, has been involved in the past and in various things going on. You might recall... the Hope Conference, I believe, was the first place that lockpicking villages actually came to the States. We saw lockpicking villages overseas. They're actual villages in camps, at the Dutch camps, at the German camps. And we thought it would be fun to have a village inside a hotel. And ever since then, lockpicking villages have been popping up all over the States in various conferences. And it's an amazing tradition. It's run by the guys known as TOOL, the Open... Okay, wait, I always get lost at this point. Go ahead.
The Open Organization of Locks.
Open Organization of Locks. And you guys spell organization with an S, too, because it's British. And that's TOOL. And these guys are amazing. They run workshops throughout the entire weekend showing people how to pick locks, what the issues are with certain locks, and they give talks that are just so incredibly riveting and that pack the room for hours at a time. And we have Click in the studio with us, who's a member, New York City member?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us something about the organization to start with.
So actually, I believe the U.S. chapter of TOOL was founded at Hope in 2008. Now, don't quote me on that, but I do believe it was founded 2008.
Okay.
So is what we do at the villages. We pretty much set up everything. Everything is there to learn how to pick a lock, and we'll walk you through step by step. So you'll start off with, like, the beginning, and we'll teach you all of the basics, everything you need to know. We have presentations every hour, so every hour you'll be able to come in, just sit down if you have any free time. And it's what you'll do is you'll learn step by step the whole process of picking a lock. And then there'll be people at the tables, like, wandering around. We'll all have TOOL shirts on. And if you have any questions at all, like, we are more than happy to answer any questions.
I have a question. As an outraged parent out there, how dare you guys teach lockpicking? Is there any use for that other than criminal applications?
So a lot of people think that, especially like locksmiths, really don't like us. But a lot of parents do come up and they can't believe that we're teaching people, like we're teaching the next criminal how to break into a house. But the real thing is that the easiest way to get into a door is to break a window. So a lot of people that are breaking into houses, they aren't picking the lock. I mean, there's a saying that all locks can be picked. It's just a matter of how long it takes to pick that lock.
Mm-hmm.
So if it takes you like 6-7 hours to pick a lock open, is somebody going to pass that lock in that period of time? And if so, then that lock is secure. So that lock won't be able to be opened. But if not, if you can open the lock in like 10 seconds, that's not a very secure lock. And that's what we try to educate people on, is how secure their locks are. Like they'll go to the store and buy like a 4-pack of these like master locks, and they'll lock up their like shed that has like tools, like gardening stuff. And is what they do is they think, oh, well, now I bought a boat and I have these 4 locks here. I'm going to lock my boat with this lock, and it's not very secure. So we try to educate people and help them understand like how secure they actually are.
And does that resonate usually when you explain it that way?
Yes, it does. Like, from that point, then they switch off of the, like, oh, well, you're doing bad things and you're teaching bad things. And then they start to be more interested in and they educate themselves. So they'll start to ask more informational questions like, okay, well, this is the kind of lock I have. How secure is this lock?
Uh-huh.
Instead of being like, well, you're just teaching all these people how to break into houses.
So overall, how secure are locks, the ones we use every day?
So I would say a majority, especially like New York City is a different breed. Like you can go to the store here, like Home Depot or Lowe's, and there'll be higher security locks. But I grew up in Oregon, and in Oregon we had – I'd go to the store and I'd buy like low-end quick sets. And even my friend, like he purchased this lock and it cost him like $210. And he was like, oh, it's one of these fancy ones with the keypads. And he like showed it to me and he's like, hey, you know, I bet you can't like pick this lock. Because it's got this digital keypad, and but it had a very like low security like Schlage in the bottom of it.
But what's, just, what's that word you just used?
Schlage.
What's
it's
that?
It's a brand of lock. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. All right. No, that's for the uninitiated.
So is Kwikset. Kwikset's a cheaper brand. And Master is another brand.
Okay, we're talking shop here on the air, folks. Okay, so what's the average time that a lock like that can be defeated?
It can actually be defeated pretty quickly. This year at Hope, we're going to run a competition. So at the competition, is what you'll do is there'll be like five or six locks set up. And it has like an electronic switch in there. So as soon as the deadbolt is released, then the timer stops for that lock. So is what you try to do is you try to pick that lock in however time it takes you to pick it. And then at the end, if all the locks are open, it'll show you who opened it the fastest and what their time is.
Wow. And how? What's the quickest somebody can do something like that?
I did it 7 seconds.
7 seconds.
And these are like house locks that like people have on their house.
Uh huh.
So they're all the same brand of lock. It's all Kwikset, but it just goes to show you like how like secure you're not.
Well, do you get people coming to you that are clearly interested in criminal intent?
Yeah. So we run all of our chapters. All throughout the U.S., we run a meeting once a month. So our meeting's every third Thursday, which is conveniently tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Great.
So, and we meet up off of 181st in New York. But is what we'll do is we'll have someone that comes in, and normally, like, the criminal type, the type of people that want to, all they want is that quick fix. They want you to tell them how to open this lock the fastest.
Mm-hmm.
What's the fastest way I can get in here? And is what we try to do is we start them off. And I'm like, okay, well, you start with this one. So this is step one, then step two, then step three. And is what they'll do is they'll get frustrated with it because they only want to know how to mm-hmm. open that lock. So, and then we kind of like, we're like, okay. And then they'll start to be like, well, you know, here's a picture of this lock. And, you know, what's the fastest way? Well, you start with this step one and you work your way up to it. So, and a lot of that we just deter by just
mm-hmm.
pushing them into like, this is how you learn. And they'll get frustrated and then they end up leaving.
Right, because you're encouraging them to learn the fundamentals, and it kind of slows down their it's like a waiting period.
Yes.
But for information.
Teaching them to fish, and they don't want to learn that. They just want the damn fish.
Exactly.
All right. Well, you know, we're familiar with this in the hacker world. People always writing in, I need a Hotmail password, I need a Gmail, Facebook, whatever. They don't want to learn how the technology works, how hacking actually is a state of mind. They just want those results. They just want the payoff.
Yeah, we have seen a lot of that at like hacker meetings and things like that, where someone will show up, you know, oh, I want to steal a credit card, or I want to break into my significant other's email, or this and that, and just how do I do that? And the people who are looking for some kind of quick and easy way to do something evil like that are not the ones who hang around in a community. It's you know, there are the people who show up and are willing to learn and have something to contribute, and you know, end up growing and learning. And you know, one of the funniest things that happened to me, I, without naming names, used to share an apartment with somebody who's also involved with Tool, and there was a certain lock on the apartment door, and watching this person keep changing the lock until there was one that they themselves could not pick, and therefore felt secure, and I felt good.
And then they lost the key. But that brings up another question. We've heard this many times in the we've seen it in the paper. Someone prints a picture of a key. It's about the worst thing they could do. I don't think a lot of people realize this. I don't think a lot of people realize that all it takes is a picture of a key, and newspapers have done this. They've had pictures of the master subway key or something like that. And that enables guys who understand the technology to just make a copy right there, right?
Yeah, it actually is very easy, especially if you know the bidding. Because a lot of the locks, they'll have biddings that go from, like, 1 to 7. So if you look at the lock, you'll be like, okay, well, I know that key blank. And from that key blank, I can hand file a key that'll open that door. And that's why, like, I don't understand, because it started off with the New York City fire keys for all the elevators. And they took a picture, and they knew after that happened that they shouldn't be doing this anymore. And then they came along with the TSA locks, and they took a picture, and they said, look how secure you are. These TSA locks are the only ones, and they're high-res photos. And they end up going online, and once it's online forever.
Now, who is it that's taking these pictures?
A news company.
Press.
Yeah.
Okay. But how are they getting to the key in the first place to take the picture?
I'm guessing they interview someone with the TSA.
And they, like, hold up your key?
And oh, they lay them down on them.
Yeah, it's like these big press conferences and stuff, basically to try to communicate a position or whatever the city is saying about it. But they very foolishly lay the stuff out or hold it up. I think this has happened in other countries in Europe too, with different keys. And it's a result also of photography, I think, becoming so rich or high resolution, as you said.
Yeah. Right, right. So you mentioned a TSA key. What did that key do?
So the TSA keys is what they try to do is I think a lot of the talk was trying to get people to buy TSA locks for their luggage. And in doing that, you would just attach that lock to your luggage, and then the TSA wouldn't have to break your lock. They would just use their master key, like a skeleton key, actually, that would go in and open that lock. And then they could go through and say, okay, there's no bombs in here, so we're just going to lock it back up.
Right.
And you'll never know.
Uh-huh.
So that's what the airport security is trying to push, is that they can go through your stuff at any time. So is what we did is as soon as, especially in like the hacking community, once you see something, then you want to go out and you want to do that. So someone posts a picture of the keys, then you're like, I can cut those keys.
Right.
I want to see if this works.
Wouldn't anybody who bought the lock also get a copy of that key?
So you get a copy of the key, but you don't get the master key. So
I see.
Some of them, they'll come with like a dial that'll have like numbers on it. So you dial the numbers in, and then they'll have like a key in the bottom. You don't get that key.
I see.
And then the other ones that come with the key, there's actually like a master key that will open all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But yours will only open yours. It won't open your friends.
Okay. Wow. Interesting. So you have so many stories to tell. I don't want to ruin the talk because I'm sure you guys have been up to a lot in the last few years. But have locks changed in recent years? Are they getting more secure?
Yeah, I wanted to ask. I mean, you guys must be laughing at all these like smart deadbolts and things with that open with apps and things. It's just
yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the community, we do a LockCon every year in the Netherlands. And out there, we get like all these lock manufacturers to come up, and they present us with these locks, and they say, hey, can you open them? So as a community, what we do is we try to find out all the flaws in the locks.
Right.
And then from there, we present it to the manufacturers. And like there was the American Padlocks had a bypass where you could just go all the way into the back and you could jimmy the lock open without even picking the lock. So we presented that to the lock manufacturers, and then they inserted a disc, a wafer disc, that prevented you from going in there. Now, can you still bypass that? Yes, you can.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, we do talk to the lock manufacturers as much as we can to help inform them of, you know, the flaws in their locks. We're not just out there like, we don't present it to the community before we go to them.
I see. Okay. And do they take you seriously?
Most of the time, they do. A lot of it is, but I think Master and Kwikset they're a little tired of us right now.
Yeah, but they keep making locks. I mean, you guys are doing them a favor by showing the insecurities.
Yeah, I say that all the time, like, because we buy so many of these, like, Kwiksets and, you know, Master padlocks that I think we're helping to fuel, like, them.
They should be sending them to you for you to test.
Well, and for to a degree, they want to sell a lot of these locks. They want to turn around their product. So they kind of don't want to have to redesign it every time and admit their mistake almost. It would be sort of it would upend their business model, right? I mean, to a degree, right? There's a little of that.
Yes. So a lot of it is, and we tell people, like, the Master Lock, it's a pretty sturdy lock. Like, yeah, you can fire a gun at it, and it's not going to fall apart. But, I mean, with like a couple two paper clips and a bobby pin, you can just pretty much pick the lock open.
So a bullet won't do it, but a paper clip will.
Yes.
It's good to know. Good to know.
So, I mean, they are good to lock things up, but things that you don't really care about is what I'd be locking up.
Is there a kind of lock that you guys recommend as being actually safe and secure?
So it's an Abloy Protect 2. I think they're coming out with a new version, but
wow,
the Abloy
okay.
locks are, they're very well done. They're disc detaining locks. So is what that means is as it's going, there's like three cycles to the lock. So as you're turning the key, it's kind of like a bank vault safe. So as you spin the dials the three different directions, well, as you're turning the key, it actually turns further than normal locks. So as you're turning, it's kind of setting it. So if you did pick it, you would have to pick it three different times.
Interesting. And have you guys done that?
I haven't. It's way above my pay grade. There are people in the Netherlands that have opened them up. They have a special tool that they use to do it.
Those guys can do anything. That's where it started, right?
Yeah.
That's where tools started. Wow.
They're phenomenal out there.
Uh-huh.
Emmanuel?
Yes, Bernie?
I just wanted to say, this is another reason for people to come to the Pope Conference. If they have some lock, maybe they found some lock or their grandfather, grandmother gave it to them, or they just have some unusual lock, and maybe they don't even have the key for it. But if they bring it to the 11th Hope, to this tool talk, actually, I think there might be more than one tool talk this year, but in any case, if they bring it, one to the workshop or one to the Hope, to the tool talk or panel discussion, there might be an opportunity to have the whole community take a look at this lock under like a macro camera, a large audience, and have comments made by people on the tool team about this lock and its history, its vulnerabilities, its strengths. And I think this is going to be a really fascinating talk. I'm not revealing too much about what's coming at Hope, but I'm really excited about this type of give and take where the audience brings interesting locks. I'm going to bring a really interesting lock, and I bet you nobody's going to be able to pick it. But in any case, this is going to be an interesting one of many interesting presentations at the 11th Hope.
So you just threw down a gauntlet, I believe, saying that they're not going to be able to pick this.
That's right.
And of course, they're going to want to try to pick this. So I look forward to this.
I wish them luck.
Yes, Rob.
So if you'd like to see somebody pick Bernie S.'s unpickable lock and maybe take a picture, come to the 11th Hope.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. So, Click, tell us, how did you get involved in lockpicking?
So I actually first started at DEF CON.
Okay.
I went there, and they say, like, a lot, this happens to a lot of people. I've been to all the conferences, helped, you know, in the village. But what happens is you end up going there, and you've got, like, your list all set up. Like, I want to see this talk, I want to see this talk, I want to see this talk.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got your whole day planned out, and then you go into one of these villages, and you sit down,
yeah.
and the whole day is gone. You're just
uh-huh.
like, I missed all these talks. And all I did was pick locks all day. And it's very addicting, especially once you start to get, like, opening the padlocks. You start to pop the locks open, and the sound of the lock opening is highly addictive.
Uh-huh. Is that where you got your nickname, Click?
No, I had it before.
Okay. We won't pry into that. But is it true that small children make particularly good lock pickers?
In some cases. It depends on how their attention span is. If they're not getting the locks open fast enough, then they tend to shove more lock picks in there, which it only takes two tools to open the lock. And a lot of people think that the more tools you have, the faster the lock will open.
Uh-huh.
But there are some kids that have done phenomenal at it. Like, they'll sit down at the tables, and they'll just go right through all the locks.
So I noticed at Maker Faire, which you guys also have a presence
yes.
at, the place is swarmed by kids. And they really are fascinated by picking locks. I think it's great. I think it's amazing interest for people to have and will only lead to positive things.
Yeah, they're
yes.
very serious, very focused. You,
uh-huh.
you see the lock pickers, and you don't want to disturb the sort of focus and intellectual like concentration that's going on there to do this puzzle, like problem solving. It's pretty amazing stuff to watch.
Yeah, it's pretty great. A few hopes ago, I'm still sort of in the nursery where lock picking is concerned. I can do some of the easy ones, but I was sitting at the lock picking village. Screwing around with one lock that was giving me trouble, and next to me was a little girl of maybe about 8 or 9 who was just breezing through these, you know, zoomed right past me and onto the next ones. And you know, there's the tendency to feel a little angry or jealous about that, but no, I was thrilled, and I thought that, you know, there's somebody who's really getting something from this conference and who is going to grow into an awesome adult probably.
Wow. Okay, well, Click, thanks so much for talking with us. You mentioned you guys have a meeting tomorrow. Is that open to the public?
Yes, open to all of our meetings across the U.S. They're all open to the public. Ours is going to be from 5:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. up off of 181st Street. If you go to our website, it's tool with three O's dot U.S.
Okay.
You can click on the members. I believe it's members. And there should give a listing of all the memberships or all the meetings in the United States.
And all the meetings take place on the third Thursday.
Just the New York City.
Oh, okay, just New York City.
Yeah, but they're all once a month, so they all have like the same day, but like a Monday or.
And about how many different chapters are there now?
Wow.
I remember when it started.
Yeah, yeah. So when it started, there was only like three or four, but it's actually I think we're up to about 20 chapters now,
wow,
all across the U.S.
Amazing. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And everything you guys are doing, it's really amazing. Tool, the open organization of lockpickers, will be at the Hope Conference again with a village that will be teaching people all kinds of things lock-related, and at least a couple of talks with all sorts of stories and educational bits. And we're looking forward to that.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Click.
Yep.
We are continuing here on Off the Hook until 9 o'clock tonight in an extended program. Again, a fundraiser. Our phone number, 516-620-3602. If you have any doubts about pledging to a radio station like this, consider where would you hear a good half-hour conversation on lockpicking that's not filled with all kinds of misinformation and fear-mongering. This is the kind of thing we do. This is the kind of thing that a station like WBAI allows us to do. And for that reason alone, it's worthy of support. So if you give a call to 516-620-3602 and pledge, what, $100, $50, whatever you can afford. There's a gift that we will send you in return. Just you can ask the people who pick up the phone what's available for that particular amount, and then it will be sent to you. But the important thing is you're supporting the radio station, keeping 99.5 FM commercial-free, and that's an amazing accomplishment right here in New York City, to be on the Empire State Building with a commercial frequency like 99.5 in the middle of the dial, and not have commercials, be 100% listener-supported. No commercials ever.
And when you call, do mention Off the Hook, because that is the name of our show. And what you'd be particularly supporting, you're supporting the station in general, but also letting the station know that that our show has its support out there. So if you go to give to WBAI.org or call the pledge line at 516-620-3602, you can see what we've got to offer you as thank you gifts, and most importantly, you can keep what we do here going.
Yes, we've been doing this on and off since 1988, believe it or not, and all kinds of history has come before these microphones. You can hear all of our shows online, www.2600.com/offthehook, from day one until tonight. So you'll see for yourself how much we've been able to cover. Imagine if the radio station was not here for us to do that. We would not have that history. We would not have that history captured.
Yeah, and I would dare say that with what's going on in the world, the mainstreaming of phones, and, you know, everybody's phone works? Yeah, you know, everybody's got them. We all are sharing in this, and it's pivotal right now what's going on with hacking and people's understanding of the impact of technology in their lives. We need your support. We need this voice here. Now more than ever, this is a critical juncture for the station and for us. We want to continue to share and report on what is going on with technology, hacking, schools, prisons, politics, you name it. We're there. We want to cover it.
It's amazing because I'm involved in the digitization of the old back issues of 2600. And I remember the second year was 1985. We started in 1984. And 1985, I believe, was the first year we got a letter saying that the hacker world is dead. There's nothing left. You know? And I've been hearing that nonstop ever since from one person or another. And all it basically means is they've given up. They've moved on to something else, and they've lost that curiosity that keeps you going in the hacker world. There is more to hack today than ever before, and the hacker spirit is so widely prevalent. I am simply amazed, and the community has grown up and matured so much. It makes me really proud.
Yeah, and part of why this particular station is such a good fit for us is because the hacker spirit is what has kept this place going. I mean, we've been doing this show, you've been doing this show since 1988. This station has been around since 1960. That's 56 years that it's been around just based on how good it is, how much actual support it gets from its listeners, because what we're doing right now, asking you to pitch in with your support, is the only thing that's kept this station going for all of those 56 years.
Imagine that.
Yeah, this place, it was a total fluke. If you go on Wikipedia or something, look up the history of this station and how it came to be, because it's far too long and
it
interesting
a story. It was won in a poker game is the story that I've heard. Well, that's actually less crazy than what really happened.
Yeah,
what really happened is a guy heard a radio station out west that he liked, was part of the Pacifica Network, and called up and said, hey, I've got a radio station in New York City I want to donate to you. Was hung up on several times as some kind of, like, you know, kook or something that made no sense. But eventually somebody believed him that he actually did have a radio station he wanted to donate to Pacifica, and that is how WBAI got started.
Right, and that would not happen again in a million years, I don't think. So, like, if we lose what we're doing here, it's not something that's going to come back. It's not something that we'll be able to just start up someplace else, because WBAI is a very unique creature, and it's a total bit of madness that it even exists, and we think it's the kind of madness that's good and valuable and worth keeping going. So if you go to give2wbai.org or call our pledge line at 516-620-3602 and show your support for our madness, and we'll have some things to give you in return.
And it is a fantastically unique voice to have hackers right broadcasting in this immense city. And sharing these ideas, you can't buy an app that does this. You can't subscribe to something else. This only comes from community radio. So we're really honored to be here, and we'd like you to show that appreciation. So give us a call, 516-620-3602, or give to WBAI.org.
And, you know, there's a lot of jaded people out there that say radio is dead, no one cares anymore, and it's, you can do everything online. If that's the case, then we should be able to just collect radio stations like baseball cards because they're worthless now. It's not the case. There are people always, entities always wanting to take over the spectrum because there's no replacement for radio. Yeah, online exists, but the signal-to-noise ratio is just incomprehensible. Usually the most successful ventures are adjuncts to actual broadcasting. When you have a broadcasting license, you open yourself up to all kinds of random listeners, people driving in their cars, people you can't actually see. And that's part of the magic of it, not knowing how many people are out there. But we always run into them at Maker Faires, at Hope Conferences, at 2600 meetings, people who listen to the radio show, just happen to hear something. People in prison even have radios. They're able to hear us. And you certainly couldn't go online and just tune into a podcast. But at the same time, it's important that we be on the Internet as well and broadcast to the world, because we hear from people in all four corners. And that is magic. That is true magic. I remember when we first started doing that in the late 90s, we were one of the first radio shows to actually reach out and broadcast over the Internet. In fact, there was talk that we might have been one of the first podcasts ever without using that actual word. And that is merging the old and the new, merging different kinds of technology. And I think there's magic to that.
Had we not ever been originating from an actual radio station, I don't think it would be the same. And I think we would sit in moments where it was critical, we'd wonder, gosh, how can we get on FM radio if we were just a stream of some kind? And I think a lot of marginalized, a lot of small communities desire that. They'd love to have the kind of ability that we have, and part of that is keeping WBAI accessible to the community here as well as us and on into the future.
Well, the other magic that you refer to is just having a place where people gather and broadcast, as opposed to, okay, now we're going to switch to this guy in his bedroom, you know, doing his particular. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, you get some really good material, but it's not a radio station. It's a lot of disconnected entities that are forming a theme, but there's no replacement for the magic of an actual gathering place. And whenever we travel, we always listen to local radio, and that's always the most fascinating part of any journey, is to listen to what people locally are doing.
Yeah, it always gives us a good indication of what the sort of mood is of a different area. And we like to think that if somebody heard our show here, they would be impressed with the mood here in the city. So, anyway, it's an honor, and it's something we'd like to keep going. So please
call us, 516-620-3602. Pledge whatever you can afford. Remember, it's not about what we send you in return as much as it's about supporting the radio station, keeping 99.5 FM commercial free. But we will send you something for whatever it is that you pledge. Just ask the people who pick up the phone, and they will help you. 516-620-3602. Bernie, anything to add to that?
Yeah, radio is not dead. It's an amazing medium. I am honored to be on the show and on WBAI for so many years. It's just a magical medium. There's nothing else like it. It's not the same as online thing or television. It is radio. It sparks the imagination. I am on a team building a community radio station here in Philadelphia. It'll be on the air July 12th. I was just able to social engineer out of the U.S. Coast Guard a great call sign, WPPM, for People Powered Media. it's going to be exciting. Our friend Matt Blaze is helping with the engineering on this station, and this is a great project. So we're actually going to try to simulcast off the hook here on WPPM 106.5 in Philadelphia.
How in the world did you get a frequency? Was it LPFM?
It's an LPFM. It'll be a 100-watt station.
Okay. Wow, that's pretty good. That's a lot of
watts. The transmitter, the antenna is going to be just on the roof with Matt Blaze last week, doing some surveying where the antenna and everything's going to go, checking out other signals and how to do this studio to transmitter link through microwave signals. And there's a lot of engineering on this, but, yeah, we're going to cover, according to the projected contour, the signal contour, we'll probably cover, about 800,000 people here in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is, about 1.5 million people. So it's about a good half of the city's population. That's no joke. So this is great. It's going to be, just like WBAI. No, in some respects, and it will be a listener-supported, non-commercial radio station. Not public radio. Not this, like NPR kind of thing where there's all these corporate underwriters and. No. We don't have these corporate underwriters on WBAI. The station here we're listening to right now is not beholden to all these corporate underwriters. Neither are all of the low power FM stations that are popping up in communities, large and small. So it's really exciting. I think radio is making a resurgence.
Yeah, it is really a thrill. That's a great project that you're involved with down there. That sounds really exciting. I'm happy for you guys that you're doing that. There's a lot that is emerging with low power FM, but it's really an important example of how this can be replicated in other areas, and people can participate. They can get involved with their own local radio. Which is really important. And I think another thing about streaming and the distinction, just to reiterate it, drive it home, I think people, you don't necessarily have to have ads on streams, but most people who set up some kind of streaming show, they're going to use a third-party service or something else that invariably throws ads in or injects some kind of payment scheme or something. It really does take a lot of engineering to do both traditional analog radio and the newer network-based stuff, or a hybrid of the two. So when you don't have that, you end up making compromises that affect the production value. So we try to keep the highest production value and quality that we can with the signal down to the equipment here in our new studios. So it's critically important how you set these things up and where you get resources and who you're beholden to, if at all. So that's very interesting, and I'm excited for that. Keep us posted, Bernie.
Yes, please.
I sure will, yeah. July 12th is our deadline from the FCC to be actually on the air on 106.5. So we only have a few weeks to go. So there's a lot of pressure. We have our transmitter ordered. We have antenna ordered. We're building the studio right now. A friend of mine named Mark, who is building who has a wireless internet service provider here in Philadelphia, is donating the microwave equipment to do the studio transmitter link.
Fantastic.
And this is all a great project coming together. It's a lot of hackers, frankly, on the technical side. It's just a group of hackers that have come together to make radio, just kind of like happened at WBAI. Just hackers like us. We're on this radio station you're listening to right now. And we've helped the station with some technical aspects over the years, and we're pleased to do it because it's a technical medium, but it's one that anybody can enjoy. And we try to do a program here on Off the Hook that anybody can listen to. They don't have to necessarily have technical skills. So anybody listening, I encourage them to call 516-620-3602. Tell the operator that you're listening to Off the Hook, and any premiums gifts that we can that are still available for Off the Hook listeners, you'll be told about them. And if not, you can just pick any other premium that's available for whatever pledge level you want to accept. The important thing is just to show some kind of financial support to keep this radio station on the air by calling 516-620-3602 or, as Rob mentioned, give2wbai.org. You can pledge online as well.
Well, Bernie, thank you for that update as to the things that you've been involved in down there in Philadelphia. It sounds really interesting and inspirational. But it's not all you've been involved in down there in Philadelphia. Bernie is very busy with all kinds of projects and activities. And I understand it's a bit of a scandal coming out of the city of Brotherly Love involving, once again, the police. And they have been caught, and I think you kind of are helping with the investigation a little bit. They were caught disguising one of their spy vehicles as none other than a Google Street View car. This is true?
Actually, it is true. It's amazing they would do something so stupid. But I just mentioned our friend Matt Blaze will be speaking at the Hope Conference, and he's very involved with making the conference happen in the background as well, Hope Conference. But the day before Matt was joining me to get on the roof of the transmitter site for WPPM here in Philadelphia, he had a dentist appointment, and he was walking to the dentist appointment past a whole bunch of police cars under this near the convention center, and he saw one would obviously look like a police car. It had two of these automatic license plate reader LPR cameras on the front, pointed at an angle outward. Some of us have seen them before that just sort of optically snap and recognize, it could be thousands of license plates per minute. And they logged them and your location of where they were logged. So that's a scary thing. And there were some other antennas on the roof of the vehicle that indicated it was a police vehicle. It was a LoJack antenna array for locating stolen cars. But the amazing thing is on the side of the vehicle was this big sign that said Google Street View. And Matt, the smart enough guy, he's like, he sent out a tweet with a picture saying WTF question mark. Can't say what that means on the air, but it was
another radio station.
Yeah. And so then people started like, wow, this is fascinating. Some people said, oh, he's photoshopped this picture. And Matt's not going to do that. He's got a reputation to protect. Another friend of mine, Dustin Slaughter, who's a reporter for Vice Motherboard, he happened to be just having lunch around the corner and saw Matt's tweet, and he ran over there and took some pictures of it too and did some more digging and called the Philadelphia police. He's an independent journalist and finally got the Philadelphia police to admit that they were in fact, it was their vehicle. It was using, plain, it was an unmarked vehicle, like a plain white SUV, but with these cameras on top of it and a Google Street View sign on the side. So the day after Matt saw this, he told me about it when I picked him up to take him over to the radio station's transmitter site. He's like, Bernie, you won't believe this thing that I saw yesterday. It was a fascinating mystery. So we were talking about it. We weren't really sure it was a Philly police vehicle. He thought it might be part of the Philadelphia Parking Authority's project. I said, no, they're a state. That's a state agency, so they wouldn't be registered to the city of Philadelphia. There was a registration card on the dash of the vehicle that said City of Philadelphia. But what agency? So Dustin Slaughter called in to the police and talked to them and finally got the police to admit that, yes, it's one of their vehicles and that the officers who operated the vehicle were not authorized to have a Google Street View signs on the vehicle. And I would imagine the folks at Google are not happy about police surveillance, dragnet surveillance vehicles being used under disguised as Google Street View vehicles. Those cameras go around, those vehicles that go around with cameras to take the pictures that you see online. So this is quite the scandal here in Philadelphia. It's been a hot topic for the past week or so. And it's just pretty amazing that the police would be so dumb to do this.
Well, just to clarify, I just wanted to ask you, Bernie, there is no, if anybody's seen a Google Street View car, they know that there is a photonics mast. Right, a spire of sorts sticking out of the top with a ball of cameras on top. That is a photonics mast on a Street View vehicle. The cameras you're referring to on this SUV are a lot slimmer profile, maybe rectangular, and they sort of sit off the hood and maybe off the back of the roof to grab license plates, right? This is not a single mast on the center of the
right. These were roof. These were near the front. These are like above the front left corner, like above where the driver sits, and then another one on the other side
sure.
above where the passenger sits. And these cameras are about the size of small shoeboxes,
right.
pointed at outward angles at both sides of the street where you would take pictures of license plates from the back and from the front of vehicle in the front of vehicles as you go down the street. So that's what this vehicle is being used for, and it was an unmarked vehicle, so this is sort of this covert surveillance, but not that covert, because
no.
the cameras are pretty obvious to anybody, but why wouldn't they be using a standard police vehicle? And then why the silly Google Street View signs on the side of it? This whole thing doesn't make sense. It just really makes you question the wisdom of the Philadelphia Police Department.
Well, I don't understand it, because people have seen, is this something new to your neighborhood? These vehicles that map out license plates, has that been seen in Philadelphia before?
I've seen them before. Each police district, I think, has at least one vehicle to do this, and there's a computer inside that logs all, and then they upload it to this database, and then they search it, because there's GPS in the vehicle, so it logs the time, the date, and the geographic coordinates of where the license plates were found.
If you had seen that before, you wouldn't have thought twice about it, because this is common, right?
Well, not that common. When I see one, I get excited because, like, oh, I saw one. Now, the Philadelphia Parking Authority operates a big white van here in Philly, too, that has cameras in the same place on the top of this van.
Right.
And I take note of it. In fact, I was stuck behind one last year, and I kept honking at them every time they were running a stop sign in front of me. And finally, they pulled over, and I said, you know, you're running all these stop signs, and you're supposed to be enforcing the traffic code, not running stop signs. And they weren't very happy about that. But
yeah,
I couldn't help it.
You like playing with fire, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm curious, where did they get the sticker that says Google Street View or Google Maps, whatever it said on the side?
It looked like it was, you know, they just, you know, photoshopped it and blew it up. It was probably about, the sticker was probably about a 18 inches high and a couple of feet wide, and it was on the left and right side of the vehicle. Yeah, I'm sure they just went to the police photo, the police graphics lab, or maybe they just went over to FedEx Kinko's and had it made. Who knows? But it was, according to the police department, the operators of the vehicle were not authorized to put those labels on it. Maybe they were, and somebody is trying to hide from that fact, but I would imagine the Philadelphia Police Department has already gotten a cease and desist letter from Google's legal department, at the very least.
Yeah, maybe the operator of that particular type of vehicle felt that obfuscating, or this attempt at obfuscating what's in the back, would just keep people from looking in through the tinted rear windows. But I'm looking at a picture here in the article, and it's definitely on a window. It's on a tinted window, not like a magnetic decal you would put on temporarily. That is affixed to this vehicle semi-permanently, basically. So whomever drives it is well aware that it's there and likely installed it themselves, as I said, because maybe they're the operator and they think this will help their job being a bit sneakier, or at least less questions a big a deal will be made of it as it's going through the community.
Yeah, nice job on that, guys. It's really worked out well for you. Now everybody's talking about it. Everyone's pointing at it. And, you know, if you see one of those vehicles, there's really not much you can do, is there? Because they are designed to read so many license plates and basically track where all these cars are. And I'm not sure if there has been much success legally challenging their existence. Does anybody know of anything?
Well, the legal point of view on that is, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy of your license plate being displayed and people seeing where and when it's displayed? And, you know, there's a good argument to say, no, you don't really have any privacy. Anybody can see your license plate when it's out parked in a public street, and they can see where it's parked and when it's parked there. What the police and departments and all the way up to federal agencies have been doing for a few years now is capitalizing on new technology. I saw it demonstrated about 10 years ago at one of the CeBIT conferences in Hanover, Germany, where they were just sucking down huge numbers of license plates with these cameras with, like, these little matchbox cars flying around a track. It's like, holy crap, this is really impressive. So, but they're what they're doing is each car has a computer that has a hot list of stolen cars or maybe cars of people they're looking for that maybe are not there's not a warrant for them, but they want to find out where they are or keep them under surveillance. And these vehicles go around, and there's not just vehicles with these cameras. A lot of overpasses and highway signs have these cameras too. A lot of intersections and especially choke points like bridges have these automatic license plate reading cameras. Look at any bridge you go over. Typically, there's cameras pointed in both directions, up and down the bridge. They're not closed-circuit TV cameras just to, like, see what the traffic pattern's on. They are logging license plates.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not really much you can do about it. Some people have tried using frontal lenses on their license plate that will make it only viewable from like, straight ahead instead of from above. I don't know how effective they are. Some people I've read have sprayed that kind of glass-etching acid on the lenses of these cameras to blind them so that the glass is no longer transparent. But, you know, that's not going to be successful on a wide scale. I think we're just going to have to get used to being our locations tracked. Even if you have your cell phone turned off now, they can tell where you are if you're driving a vehicle and the vehicle's registered to you or to your friends. It's part of the whole mesh
mm-hmm.
of its surveillance that's going into the giant government databases of where we're going, with whom, when and where. And I don't think there's any privacy grounds on this particular thing, unfortunately.
You're starting to sound like Steve Rembrandt, but unfortunately that seems to be the reality. So there's no way to actually detect these devices, is there? Is it passive technology?
No, they're just passive cameras. They don't emit any signals that you could pick up. But, you know, you can see them. You can see the vehicle.
Well, maybe you can see them. Maybe.
Well, usually, I mean, there are some covert. I'm sure there are covert vehicles that have these cameras, like hidden in a dash or hidden in it, like behind the grill or something. But all, I mean, I've seen several of them that have the cameras right on top of the vehicle. They're just more effective and they work that way. But
well, then my next question is: if we can't defeat the things, how do we get the things so we can play with them?
Well, that's a good question. You can. You can buy these cameras.
All right.
People can search ALPR cameras online, and there are private companies that buy these things too. They're like companies that do automobile repossessions. They buy these cameras, and a lot of these repo companies will purchase the data from private companies that have these cameras up, and to help them find cars that they want to repossess. So it's.
I would like, Bernie, and maybe you can help us design this. I would like to get a system like that and program it to simply look for police cars. And draw a little map as to where all the police cars in the neighborhood are.
I like this idea.
Yeah, maybe we can have an app on phones that will tell you where your favorite cop happens to be at the moment. And, I've tried to do that just by noticing with my own eyes, okay, this guy tends to go around here. You'd be surprised how quickly you get familiar with their habits. But why not? If the technology works against people, it should work against everybody equally.
And police, you'd think, would want people to know that the police are around, you know, as a deterrent.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of cops, they just want to be sneaky.
All right. Well, we're going to have to keep exploring that. I'm sure there'll be some conversation about this at Hope 2, if not a full-fledged talk. Hey, we're at the past the halfway point here at WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. We are now taking up the time of the personal computer show. We have them tied up outside. They're not getting in tonight. Because we've commandeered the studios. Well, we were told to do that. And we are on for 2 hours this week. We are not on next week. And that's just how we're doing things during the fundraisers. So maybe they'll be on for 2 hours next week. I don't know. I didn't see the schedule. But we have a musical break, and then we have a special guest coming on after the musical break. But Rob, do you want to tell us something about what we're about to hear?
We spoke about this maybe 3-4 weeks ago when news of its production was circulating. But the French electronic musician Jean-Michel Jarre, who is a pioneer in that field, has been for very many decades, visited Edward Snowden in Russia and did some recording. So Jean-Michel Jarre's newest album, Electronica 2, The Heart of Noise, contains this track Exit, which contains vocals now from Edward Snowden. So,
I had no idea this existed. This is awesome.
Well,
wow.
You were away when we were reporting on it, so this will teach you to travel.
Well, that's what Jean-Michel did to go over there and make this recording in the first place.
Absolutely. So on top of everything else Mr. Snowden has accomplished, he's now an electronic music vocalist.
Well, let's give a brief listen to this. Hopefully this will work. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Jean-Michel Jarre with Edward Snowden here on Off the Hook.
The question is, why are our private details that are transmitted online, why are private details that are stored on our personal devices any different than the details and private records of our lives that are stored in our private journals?
I think, you know, saying that you don't care about the right to privacy because you have nothing to hide is no different than saying you don't care about freedom of speech because you have nothing to say. It's a deeply antisocial principle because rights are not just individual, they're collective. And what may not have value to you today may have value to an entire, you know, population, an entire people, or an entire way of life tomorrow. And if you don't stand up for it, then who will? And if you don't stand up for it, then I will.
Wow, I'm impressed. What a great track. That's Jean-Michel Jarre and Edward Snowden. This shows the power of music and speech when combined, what you can do. Really proud of what Edward has done and what he continues to represent, and hope that this whole thing works out. And he's celebrated for the freedom fighter he actually is, and defender of individual liberties. So much we've learned in the last few years.
Manning, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Chelsea Manning. So many heroes out there. And so many more still to come. So
yeah.
That's what I mean when I say I'm very proud of the hacker community, because that community has grown so much and has such ideology that is really worthwhile.
Yeah, and as someone who emailed the show with this information weeks ago mentioned, Jar knows of what Edward speaks with this stuff. His own mother was a member of the French Resistance, was a survivor of concentration camps.
Wow.
So he and Jar, who I would definitely term a hacker, just you know, because I'm a fan of his work, and it really exemplifies a lot of the hacker spirit, I think. He's applying that to his work and using it to express something important here. And
it's inspirational.
It really is.
Yeah, it's inspirational on so many levels, whether you're a writer, whether you're a musician, or just somebody who cares. And I've been listening to Jean-Michel Jarre since the 70s, so it's just great to...
If you don't speak the fourth, then I will.
It's just great to hear these voices combined. Wow. Okay, thanks for that, Rob. Thanks for sharing that. Hey, you might have been seeing something on the net in the last couple of weeks from a blog known as Vellum Atlanta, and it's basically, the title was "Apple Stole My Music." No, seriously. This is one hell of a story. This guy, James, was talking to a customer service rep known as Amber. We've all talked to Amber at one point or another.
Does she still work there?
I think so. She works everywhere. Now, he had just explained to Amber that 122 gigs of music files were missing from his laptop. That's a lot of music. That's a good amount of music there. Depending on how you encoded it, that's a lot of music. I'd already visited the online forum, he said. Basically tried that. They were no help whatsoever. Several people had described problems similar to mine, but they were all dismissed by condescending gurus, and we've all met them as well.
Those aren't geniuses, though.
Some of them consider themselves geniuses. I don't know if they actually label that way, except in the stores.
Okay.
They said that he and people like him had mislocated their files. He had the free drive space to prove that was not the case. The files were gone. I'm sure they would say that he just deleted his files, and I don't know. Basically, Amber explained, "I should blow off those dismissive solutions offered online because Apple employees don't officially use the forums. Evidently, that honor is reserved for lost, frustrated people such as myself. And at least in this case, know-it-alls would rather believe we were incompetent or lying and face the ugly truth that Apple has vastly overstepped its boundaries." Now, what Amber explained was exactly what I had feared. Through the Apple Music subscription, which I had, Apple now deletes files from its users' computers. When I signed up for Apple Music, iTunes evaluated my massive collection of MP3s and WAV files, scanned Apple's database for what it considered to be matches, then removed the original files from my internal hard drive, removed them, deleted them, and if Apple Music saw a file it didn't recognize, which came up quite often, since I'm a freelance composer and have many music files I created myself, it would then download it to Apple's database, delete it from my hard drive, and serve it back to me when I wanted to listen, just like it would with my other music files it had deleted. In other words, it's no longer on his computer, but Apple would give it to him when he needed it. Okay, this leads to four immediate problems. If Apple serves me my music, that means that when I don't have Wi-Fi access, I can't listen to it. When I say my music, I don't just mean the music that over 20 years, since before iTunes existed, I painstakingly imported from thousands of CDs and saved to my computer's internal hard drive. I also mean original music that I recorded and saved to my computer. Apple and Wi-Fi access now decide if I can hear it, and where, and when. That's the first problem. Number two, when Apple considers what Apple considers a match, often is not. That rare early version of Fountains of Wayne's "I'll Do the Driving," labeled as such, still had its same label, but was instead replaced by the later released, more widely available version of the song. The piano demo of Sister Jack that I downloaded directly from Spoon's website 10 years ago, replaced with the alternate, more common demo version of the song. What this means, then, is that Apple is engineering a future in which rare or varying mixes and versions of songs won't exist unless Apple decides they do. Said alternate versions will be replaced by the most mainstream version, despite their original at one time correct titles, labels, and file contents. That's problem number two. Problem number three, although I could click the little cloud icon next to each song, next to each song title, and get it back from Apple, their servers aren't fast enough to make it an easy task. It would take around 30 hours to get my music back. And even then, problem number four, should I choose to reclaim my songs via download, the files I would get back would not necessarily be the same as my original files. As a freelance composer, I save WAV files of my own compositions rather than MP3s. WAV files have about 10 times the number of samples, so they just sound better. Since Apple Music does not support WAV files, as they stole my compositions and stored them in their servers, they also converted them to MP3s or AACs. So not only do I need to keep paying Apple Music just to access my own files, but I have to hear an inferior version of each recording instead of the one I created. Wow. I saw this story and I was simply blown away, but I recognize the attitude. I recognize people buying into nonsense like this and allowing a corporation to take control of something they collected, something they organized, and applying their rules to it. And this is a dramatic example of what can happen. James of Vellum, Atlanta, joins us now on the phone. James, this is an incredible story. You must have gotten a lot of reaction to it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was not expecting such a strong reaction. I thought maybe a few hundred people would read the blog and maybe a dozen would be helped by it. And, you know, that's really what I was trying to do. But I posted the blog and I woke up early the next morning because my boss texted me like, have you seen the Twitter feed? It has exploded. And then, you know, I checked my Facebook and someone said, oh, it's on Reddit. You know, it was on the top of the front page when I looked. And it was a lot more attention than I was ready for, I have to say.
Well, people care about things like this, and what you exposed here resonates, I think, with a lot of people, because if it hasn't happened directly to us, we fear that something like that might happen.
Yeah, I think we're all realizing we have so many different systems and so many different devices at varying stages of development or being obsolete, and then we simply sort of cycle in new things, and we see this sort of conflict and overlap and now overreach. And it's fascinating how you sum this up.
Oh, well, thank you. And you know, I have to say that the story has changed as it's gone on because, you know, Apple called me that very day.
I can imagine.
It was a little nerve-wracking. You know, I got on my cell phone, too. You know, I'd been getting calls from reporters on Vellum's landline, you know, the office at which I work, the office that published the blog. But Apple, you know, they read my name, looked up my file, and called me on my cell phone because that's the number they have for me, which, you know, makes sense. If I have to contact a vendor or a customer at work, I'll look up previous information from them, get the number. But it just seemed eerie, you know, coming from Apple corporate. But they were very polite on the phone, and what they explained to me when we spoke was Oh, hey, look, it is not supposed to do that deliberately. But at the time, they hadn't yet read the transcripts of the call. So they, you know, they didn't want to say I was making this story up, but they just said it's not supposed to do that. And when they had called back, because we had a few conversations, they finally revealed, okay, we read the transcripts, and they didn't dispute what Amber said to me. They just said, we swear it's not supposed to do that. We don't know why she said that. And, you know, I told them, well, it's not just that she said it's supposed to do that. She said she's gotten many calls like this, and that's why by now she knows the answer. The answer is it's supposed to do that. And they said, well, you know, this is the first we've heard of this. We'll need to look into it. But, you know, we take this seriously, of course. So, you know, they called me back a couple times over that week, and they asked if I would be comfortable if they sent a couple engineers to my house.
Oh, boy.
Try to help troubleshoot. Exactly. And, you know, that in and of itself was intimidating as well. But once again, the whole reason I did this, my music collection means everything to me. And, of course, I had backups. I was able to restore from a backup. Here's something interesting that I didn't work into the blog because, you know, narration-wise, it just didn't flow well. But this happened twice because the first time I caught it, I went back to a previous backup and I reinstalled all my music onto my hard drive and I relinked it to iTunes because I thought surely this was a freak thing, you know, this was a freak thing. So I redid it all and then it happened again, like a day and a half later. So by the time I talked to Amber, she was actually the third Apple genius I had spoken to, and I was transferred up to her. She was a senior advisor. So when a senior advisor told me, yes, that's what the software is supposed to do, you know, it made me very angry. I took umbrage with that, but I also believed her. And then, you know, as soon as this post went public, I had Apple calling me and saying, no, it's not supposed to do that. So that, you know, that threw me for a loop because I wasn't sure which Apple representative I was supposed to believe. And it put me in an awkward position because I had already rung the bell. You know, mm-hmm. The blog had 1.8 million views in the first 24 hours. So then I had to be like, well, okay, guys, now they're saying it wasn't supposed to do that, but I'll keep you posted.
But they didn't deny that it did that, correct?
Exactly. They didn't deny that it did that. You know, they weren't able to tell me exactly why, and they do claim that my case is very unique. They say there are very few people, but, you know, a large number of people have come forward online and said something similar happened.
Well, James, why would your case be unique? It sounds like what you were doing is what lots of people do.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that either. You know, they were trying, you know, they wanted me to help them replicate it, which is why they did actually fly two of their senior engineers from California to my house this weekend, and I spent a good deal of Saturday and a little bit of time Sunday trying to recreate the issue with them.
And did you succeed?
We did not succeed in recreating the issue. And, you know, one of the perplexing things, and I warned them about this, I said, I had Apple Music for 8 months before this happened, so why now? And, you know, I brought that up with Amber, and she didn't have an answer for that, but she maintained that is what it's supposed to do. Now, when I had spoken to the lower-level Apple geniuses when I first called, you know, the first person I talked to, she wasn't quite sure what was going on, but she tried to spin it like, but, you know, now you have all this free hard drive space.
Oh, wow.
like, that's a good thing, except, like, you know, lose weight by cutting off your arm.
wow, that's a real cheerful attitude. I'm worried, though, do you think every Amber at Apple was interrogated until they found the right one, and what might have happened to her?
I'm thinking they just looked up the case number, because as soon as they read my name, they were able to get my cell phone number from my file and give me a call. And once again, you know, that was a little intimidating, but I get it. I don't think they overstepped any bounds doing that in particular. But, you know, my name is, I'm sure, attached to every time I've called in and spoken to an Apple genius or called in for Apple Care or anything like that. So, and evidently they do keep transcripts of the calls. So from there, it was probably pretty simple for them to look through and be like, okay, he called. Because I called two different times. I called the first time. They couldn't figure it out. They tried to sell me on the, well, at least you have more hard drive space issue. So I reinstalled everything. And then when it happened a couple days later, of course, I was extra mad by now.
Right.
And the first gentleman to whom I spoke there, it was just over his head. And he's the one who transferred me up to Amber.
So it sounds like they did take a keen and immediate interest in what was going on by calling you directly. After you had spoken with their support people as well as publishing a bit about this.
I think they took a keen interest as soon as it hit the internet.
Spreading the word probably was the clincher on that part of it.
Well, James, I'm curious. Go ahead.
But they didn't end up finding like a checkbox or something in your settings and then say, oh, you didn't do that. That didn't come out of this thing over the weekend.
No, that didn't come out of the thing. They could find no evidence of user error. And they told me, after having spoken to you, you know, I'm by no means a programmer. I'm by no means a hacker. But, you know, I've been using iTunes since it existed. I've been using Apple products since the 2GS came out. When the 2GS came out, I was playing Task Times and Tonetown.
Wow.
You know, so, like, I've been using Apple products for a very long time. And I like to think I wouldn't accidentally highlight 98% of my music files and then delete them and then confirm and then empty the trash.
How many iPhones have you bought?
I'm only actually on my third, believe
it
or not.
That's all right. That's some loyalty there to Apple.
I ride them till the wheels come off. Oh,
that's the spirit.
I've been using Apple products for a very long time. And that was something, a side note that, you know, was really interesting but also kind of nerve-wracking, you know. There are so many ideological wars going on between people who love Apple and people who hate Apple. And you know, I wasn't interested in grabbing a bat with a nail through it and joining some gang that's either against Apple or for Apple. I was just saying, hey, they really made me mad with this one thing, and now they're saying it wasn't supposed to happen that way, so I'm in a strange position here.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you're doing people a favor by exposing this and keeping it from happening to them if they fix it.
Well, exactly, and that's my hope too. And you know, when they came, when they spent the 2 days with me at my house, they didn't pay me for that. I pretty much gave up my weekend just to spend time
with them.
They
spent 2 days in your house?
Well, they not two full days. They arrived Saturday morning. We were there for several hours troubleshooting, and then they came back on Sunday. They actually gave me some homework on Saturday night. They said, "Do whatever you normally do, because you know it might be a unique combination of the ways in which you use iTunes." So.
Uh-huh.
I told them, okay, if this were a normal Saturday night, I might buy one or two songs from the iTunes store. I might mess around with a couple playlists. I might import a couple of my own mixes from Pro Tools or Logic. And I would end the night streaming music through the Apple TV from my laptop, you know, with home sharing. I would stream some playlists through the Apple TV in the living room while my wife and I hang out and drink some beers and play Boggle. So that's the homework. I'll do that.
Uh-huh.
So I went through all those motions. And they came back on Sunday to collect the data, and they did. And, you know, they have logs of everything, but the mass deletion didn't happen again, which was, you know, the smoking gun they were looking for. And we weren't able to recreate that. But once again, I knew that would probably be the case because the time I'd had Apple Music 8 months before it happened once. But then it did happen a second time 2 days later.
Hey, James.
Yes.
This is Bernie in Philadelphia.
I'm sorry
with you. Hi. You would think that Apple would have logs at their end too, their own server logs as to what's going on at their end. And they have their own? Don't they have their own test beds there with, like, you know, rooms full of computers like yours that they can run every conceivable combination of things against? Isn't that what they're supposed to be doing? It's almost like they're questioning. like almost doubting you. I mean, obviously you're telling the truth, and I don't know. I would feel like, you know, this is your God job to figure this out at your end. I'm not getting paid for my weekend. You guys are getting paid for your weekend. Like, why do I have to give up my weekend for you to fix your problems, which shouldn't have happened in the first place? Don't you have the tools on your end to look at what happens from there?
Yeah, and that's a very fair point, and that's a very fair point. And I was kind of guarded, I have to admit, because, you know, they were running these logs, and, you know, obviously, like the joke I made in my blog update, it's not like I have the unedited Zapruder film on my computer, but still, you know, I don't want them poking around through every little thing. I have work stuff on there. And also, you know, I made some conditions, you know, you can rifle through my iTunes, my music library, anything affiliated with Apple Music, but any information you glean from this is strictly for troubleshooting and, of course, you know, maintain my confidentiality. I wasn't worried so much about the confidentiality after the San Bernardino phone incident. I figured they would still, you know, be looking out for my confidentiality. But I do realize, obviously, there was a lot more at play than them just helping me. They're trying to improve the program and, of course, to make sure I'm not some lunatic or I didn't make some completely idiotic mistake. So, you know, we talked through a lot, and they were satisfied with that. They actually said, we do not believe this is user error. Nothing leads us to believe this is user error. And, you know, I was able to point out to them, too, it's not that every like 98% were. And the remaining ones, they varied by artist name. It would be different if only Frank Zappa on remained. Then I'd be like, oh, I must have deleted A through Y in my library accidentally. But it wasn't like that. The files that remain were scattered throughout the alphabet. They varied by date added. They varied by file type. You know, so it was so random what remained, it would have been a very, very elaborate accidental deletion on my part to pull that off.
So, James, this is Rob. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me.
Definitely. We've seen now this story go way viral on the net, and we've seen so many times in these sorts of things that some big monolithic company has a customer with a problem, and they're not helpful to the customer, so the customer posts about it, and then it gets big. It gets, you know, maybe 1.8 million hits on their blog or something,
right.
And that's when the company will step in and go, oh, we better take care of this, and that's where the power with this sort of thing is, but. It's really funny. I mean, did in your interactions with Apple after your story went viral, did they make any mention of that as like that being a factor in how they're taking care of you now?
Not specifically. They said we're eager to help you at first, you know, solve your problem. And I pointed out, well, if you read the blog, I had several backups. I don't have a problem now. I just don't trust Apple Music, especially based on what your senior advisor told me that it's supposed to do. And, you know, they reiterated, well, she was incorrect. We're sorry she told you that. We're sorry this happened to you. And, you know, I have to say, too, they always had a warm tone on the phone. They were, you know, and obviously they didn't want to make me any more angry. But I realize now, like, I don't know what to believe as far as whether or not it was supposed to, but it does seem crazy that it would do that on purpose, because I would think that would be a PR nightmare for them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have said, well, I have Apple Music and this never happened to me. So I'm willing to believe that it was a bug. It's just, if there's nothing else to this story, if it was just a bug, it's still a story about how they need to better train the people answering the phone regarding what they tell the customers the software is supposed to do and not supposed to do. And, you know, it's also a testament to everyone out there who doesn't back up their data. Like, back up your data redundantly and then some.
And so with it going viral, could you talk a bit about the response that you've gotten just from other people, maybe others who have had this problem or things like it?
I've had some people who were pretty vague about it, you know, oh, that's why I don't use Apple, because this happened to me. And, you know, there's not much to go on there. But, you know, there was one gentleman who posted a video on YouTube showing how it happened to him, and he went through his Time Machine backups, and he said, you know, when I look through, I see now that this full album I used to have only has 3 songs. Where did the other 9 go? And he's scrolling through his Time Machine backups and showing, they're here, they're here, they're here, bam, suddenly gone. I did not delete these files. He posted a video on YouTube. It was called Apple Stole My Music, No Seriously, I Mean For Real, or something like that. But then he changed the title later because both he and I, we were getting a lot of pushback from Apple apologists who were saying, don't use the word stole. They were storing it for you. a lot of people really took offense to me using the word stole, but that's what it felt like to me, because, if you know, they didn't know whether or not I had backups. And what the senior advisor told me once again was, well, you don't have a copy, but don't worry, because we do.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the word stole the first time in your blog entry when you were referring to your own music being taken off of your machine and stored on their servers.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, I think the word applies there. It was not for your convenience.
Yeah, they weren't.
Well, exactly. And let's say, and you know, as I said, I'm willing to believe that it's a bug and that Amber misspoke or she didn't really understand how the software worked. But, you know, she's a senior advisor. I took her word for it. That was what I went with. And I hope the blog at least helps people. It reminds them to back up their data. And, you know, Apple did it. They acknowledged there's a bug, and they said they're working on a fix, and the new iTunes update came out today. I read through the fine print, and I couldn't find anything that spoke specifically to the deletion issue. So I don't know if this update was even the one that handles it or not. But the point is, if they haven't fixed it yet, they're at least putting fail-safes in there now. So if they can't pinpoint the bug, they're at least trying to come up with ways to prevent it from deleting, even if the bug kicks in. Which, you know, which is a good thing, and that's, as this went on, eventually that was all I wanted, was other people not to lose their libraries.
Right. So I have a question, just to kind of backtrack a little bit and go through the steps that you went through. The first time you noticed this, you randomly noticed that all of a sudden your music wasn't there, correct?
Yeah. Well, what happened was, it was a Friday night, I just made a Jack and Coke. I was getting ready to, you know, blast the music Friday night party style. And I went to click on a song, a Camper Van Beethoven song called It Was Like That When We Got Here.
Okay.
And it was on a lag. And I thought, well, that's odd. My processor shouldn't be burdened with anything else. I don't have any other applications open.
It wasn't like that when you got there.
Exactly.
Couldn't have picked a better song.
So what I did was... I thought, this is odd. It's almost as if this song is being served to me like it would from Apple Music,
mm-hmm.
even though I ripped this personally as a WAV file because I really like that song. The songs I really like, you know, I rip as WAV files from the CDs I buy. So, I thought something was odd. So I turned off the Wi-Fi, and then I double-clicked it, and it wouldn't play, and it was gray. And then I thought, okay, that's really odd. It's almost as if Apple Music looked at my library, and now it's trying to supersede what's already on my drive and serve me these songs I already have. So then that was when I thought, well, I better check. And so I looked in my, Command-N, I made a new window, I clicked on Music, I clicked on iTunes, I opened the iTunes Music folder, and in the folder there were far fewer artists than there normally are. There were maybe 50, 60 when there are normally, you know, thousands in there.
Was there anything unique about those 50 or 60 that remained?
No, They were, as I said, they were all over the alphabet. They varied by date added. They varied by file type. I couldn't find anything. And something I didn't notice right away that I wish I had picked up on sooner, there were certain albums that many tracks were missing and others weren't. There were a couple albums where just the digital booklet remained. You know how sometimes when you download an album, you get that digital booklet with it?
So it's basically like an algorithm or a computer basically just ransacked your media, your music folder with all of the artists, irrespective of anything, with no real discernible pattern.
They were all on the same hard drive? They were all in the same directory structure?
Exactly, yes, and, you know, all in my internal hard drive, people have asked, well, were you connected to an external drive? Is that where you store your music? And the answer is no. They were all on my internal hard drive. So what I did then, I was like, oh, my gosh, I have to recover these. I had them backed up in a couple different places, but Time Machine was one of them, one of my Time Machine drives. So I plugged in and went to Time Machine, and that's when I noticed, oh, some of these have been missing for a couple days. I just didn't notice because I had the Wi-Fi turned on. So when I would click on a song title, it would just play. And then I realized, you know, so for a couple days, most of these have been missing. But then I found a Time Machine backup that still contained them. It was, I believe, March 27th was the last backup I had that still had everything. So I added all of the files again. And then, in iTunes, I said file, add to library, and I re-added everything. And, you know, it was kind of a waste of time. That was a little bit aggravating, but I thought, well, this is weird. And, of course, I was open to the idea that maybe I somehow clicked some combination of preferences or settings or something that had done this.
Right.
You know, I was open to that. I was just confused. So that was when I made the first call to Apple, and that was when the person, you know, she wasn't sure what was going on, but she tried to remain upbeat about the fact that I now had free drive space, and that, you know, that's a plus for some customers. And obviously I wasn't feeling that approach. So, you know, I hung up with her, but I thought, okay, I reinstalled it all. It should be back to normal. And it was for maybe a day and a half. And then it happened again. And then I realized, oh my God, you know, it did it again. So that was when I called back and the first representative didn't know and transferred me up to Amber. And the whole time I was thinking, this must be a bug. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't call. I didn't have a pitchfork ready to go. You know, with these people at Apple, I just assumed this must be a bug. It was her telling me, no, the software is supposed to do this, that changed everything for me. And that's the reason that blog post had such a hostile tone.
Now, the second time it happened, were they basically the same bits of music, or was it different?
They were basically the same ones.
Interesting. And I imagine it didn't show up in your trash. You weren't able to recover that way.
No, did not show up in the trash. And I did look, although I'll say this too, you know, I habitually empty the trash fairly often. So, you know, I may have emptied the trash when they were in there and didn't notice. But the other thing is, we're talking about 17,000 songs.
I think you'd
like
notice that.
So,
yeah, you would have noticed
exactly.
That.
I would notice the progress bar of emptying the trash of 17,000 songs. Unless I hit empty trash and then just got up and walked away, you know, I'm open to believing that may have been the case, but I didn't see it happen.
Is it possible anybody else has access to your machine?
You know, that crossed my mind, too, but just not that I can think of. I mean, you know, it's password protected. You know, my wife has her own computer, and she doesn't really mess with mine because, you know, she just uses it for the bare minimum. You know, internet, she edits photos, but that's pretty much it. She doesn't really mess with my music or anything like that. But, of course, I asked. You know, I wanted to do my due diligence, so I said, like, have you touched anything here? Have you changed anything here? Have you? And she was like, oh, no, of course.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I asked her again, once the blog got all that, I could ask this again, but you have done nothing to my computer. And she was like, no, of course not. But once again, it would have been so elaborate what she would have had to do to delete those specific files, but not all of them.
Yeah,
it would have been pretty time-consuming for her. You know, you could click on one track, Command-A, to highlight them all, but then you'd have to strategically go through and unselect or deselect many of them.
That is
and then
weird.
Right.
You know, exactly.
It's the type of thing that only a computer or some kind of crazy algorithm could be doing very quickly and sort of haphazardly. It's not something a human would be dedicated to randomly screwing things up and making everything in disarray or being so unpredictable.
James, one more question. I don't mean to interrogate you on this. I am very curious, though. Is it possible that those files or those directories were shareable on a network?
I don't think so. I don't think so, but just the fact of what was deleted versus what remains, like some of those tracks I forgot I even had. Some were on very active playlists I use all the time. Most were somewhere in between. So I just don't see how some would have remained and others wouldn't have, because there was no so little rhyme or reason to what was deleted and what remained that I just don't see how any of that could have made sense.
And did it just you just opened up the program and they were gone, or were you in the middle of using the program and then they disappeared?
No, I opened up the program and they were all still listed. It's just that they were all almost all being streamed to me. 98% of them weren't present in my library.
I see.
They were just, you know, it was playing me the Apple Music version, which, of course, you know, can be if you have, like, that rare acoustic version of a song, there's a good chance Apple Music will play the version from the band's greatest hits, even if it leaves your label the same, saying rare
right.
acoustic version.
That is a real problem, as people rely on Grace Notes and the like to label their music. You might get it labeled wrong, and then good luck finding it in your library when you think you have something else and it's completely inaccurate.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, it's just been a strange experience, but I have to say that they have convinced me that it was a bug.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're saying it's a bug now. I do believe that it's a bug. It's just it's been a strange journey getting here. but they have me convinced. And another thing that put me in a strange position, I got to say, the two guys who came to my house, they were cool. I mean, they were good guys. We, mm-hmm. You know, I found them very relatable as people. We had good conversations. They were very polite and respectful in my home. You know, even though they knew that I had written this thing that caused them a headache, they were conference calling with other engineers in California, and I said, like, so how many people's weekend did I ruin who are at work right now?
Yeah, but you also did them a service by discovering this.
Oh, absolutely. And, well, and they were grateful for that, too. So, you know, it just made things extra strange for me because I came out so angry. I can't believe Apple would do this to their customers, and what does this mean for the future?
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, I was thinking about, like, when George Lucas goes back and changes a Star Wars movie and everybody gets angry, I was like, oh my gosh, if the only versions we can see are the ones being served to us, anyone can rewrite history now. It will always be that Han didn't shoot first, if they say so.
Wow, I think the NYPD might be interested in some of this technology, too. I'll have to check back on
that. Very good. He had a gun. Look, we edited it in.
Yeah. What did iTunes make of your own original music when it tried to serve you their own version? Did it relabel it as anything else? Or
No. It was good about keeping the labels the same with those. It was just the file type was different. And you know, even that, of course, I wouldn't be so dumb as to only save the single copy of my own music in my iTunes library, and that's the only place. It was the principality of, I did not give you permission to do this, and you're telling me that's what the software is supposed to do? I just really quickly went into how dare you mode. And when I wrote that blog post, I actually sat on it for 2 weeks because I just kept thinking, like, this is crazy. They would really do this? This is crazy.
How?
But, you know, I kept replaying the conversation in my head, and I was like, no, I mean, they told me they did this on purpose. All right, I got to publish this. But I still just never dreamed that it would get so much attention.
How certain?
Hey, James.
Yes.
Go ahead, Bernie.
I'm sorry. James, before you go, I just wanted to know, what's your what do you do down there in Atlanta, both work and what do you enjoy doing besides your music collection? And
oh, thank you. Yeah. My 9-to-5 job, I'm the manager of a photography and design studio, so I produce photo shoots and manage a studio where we do like brand visualization, color palettes, things like my boss is very good at telling you next year what color will be popular. So, I do a lot of that. You know, that's my 9-to-5, but she's good about letting me blog about whatever I want on the blog, and, you know, that worked out well for her this particular month, I guess. But, you know, on the side, I compose a little bit. You know, just selling little catchy little instrumentals for commercials and stuff like that. So that's really what I enjoy doing. I'm a musician myself. And, you know, I know you guys were talking about electronic music earlier, and I'm a big synth pop fan myself, and I tinker with that. I'm in a band called Evening Shade, and that's all one word. That's, you know, a synth pop act, and I'm just trying to recreate that cool, I don't know, somewhere in between danceable stuff and that early John Carpenter sound, which even John Carpenter is back into now.
I'll have to check my iTunes collection, see if Apple gave me any of your music.
good. Yeah, maybe they were Robin Hood and they just took it from me and gave it to other people.
So I had one quick question. So how certain were they that they might be able to get to the bottom of this, and what kind of timetable? Do you have any idea how soon you might be able to get some more information, when they might be able to get back to you about it? Because it sounds like Amber didn't really know. I mean, she knew it was supposed to work that way, but she wasn't so certain. She was explaining the whole process that maybe they weren't supposed to tell anyway or something. Do you have a sense that they'll follow up and you'll get a little bit deeper into why and what is going on and what the confusion was with their support people?
Well, as of right now, I haven't heard back from them since I saw the two engineers on Sunday. I did ask them, please keep me updated. And I told them, too, okay, you've convinced me that this is probably a bug, in which case, I obviously have a friendlier tone with you guys now, but I would still love to know what this is. And, I hope you understand the awkward position I'm in now, because it was your own representative, who told me this was supposed to happen on purpose. So, I'm believing you Apple guys over that other Apple employee now. It just puts me in an odd position.
Well,
so many people read
whether it happened on purpose or whether it happened by accident, it's not something that you did. It's something that happened as a result of a configuration or a bad decision of one part or another. I think people deserve to know why that happened and how to prevent it from happening again.
Exactly. And they haven't. I found it interesting. The way they worded it is they're installing safeguards to make sure it doesn't happen. So I don't know that they've been able to isolate the bug yet. I just think they're putting extra measures into the code to say, hey, if anything starts to get deleted, just stop, because that's not supposed to happen. And, forgive my crude way I'm explaining this here. I'm obviously not a programmer, but you know what I'm saying? By fail-safes, I think they'll look for certain triggers. Like if things get moved to the trap, will kick in and move it right back to your collection is what I'm assuming.
It'd be nice to pinpoint when is this happening and what triggered it, and I think that's something that they can figure out with some time.
Yeah, it'll be very curious to hear more of an elaborate response about how their software is not designed to do that instead of such certainty about how it is designed to do that.
And I'm sure our listeners will be experimenting day and night trying to get this to happen to their collection as well.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting you say that, guys, because with this new iTunes update that came out just yesterday, I did not install it on my laptop because I keep thinking, or maybe it even came out today, but I haven't installed it on my laptop because I keep thinking, if this has those safeguards, I will never be able to replicate this problem. And I have backups, so it's not the end of the world if this happens again to me.
Yeah, I know how you feel. I've been clinging to the same iTunes version for about 10 years now.
Well, that's a wise man, because there are so many bells and whistles now that it's dizzying.
Yeah, I don't like bells and whistles. I just like music.
Exactly, which is why when I was in the thick of all this, I tried Swinsian, and I was really impressed because it's so much like the earlier versions of iTunes that, I had a good experience with that. And it instantly, as soon as I said, here's my iTunes, I was listening within 30 seconds. I couldn't believe how quickly it integrated. But anyway, regardless, my point is I'm going to try to keep using iTunes. I'm going to avoid the update for a while at least and see if this happens again, because I think it still might be able to help people, and maybe it will help them, figure out what this bug is. Because if these safeguards work, now they have no motivation to actually track down what the bug was, and I'm dying to know myself. Not that I would even probably understand it.
Well, James, it's been a fascinating story, and I hope you give us updates as things change. I'm not hoping that your library gets wiped out again, but if it does, I hope you let us know so that we can maybe help you figure out just what's causing this. And, of course, if other listeners have similar things happen to them, write to us, oth@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you. James, good luck, and keep us updated.
Will do, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on.
Take care.
Okay, you too. Bye.
And that was James of Vellum Atlanta. You read his blog post at Vellum Atlanta. That's VellumAtlanta.com. And what a story. His music library wiped out, apparently, by Apple and replaced by their versions of his songs, served to him from their remote servers. As long as he remains a customer, he can keep his music that he encoded himself. I don't think in any universe they would say, yeah, this is a good idea, at least not for very long.
Unless you're Amber, I guess. But
Amber just might have been cynical.
She might have.
Yeah.
But this is really a symptom of something much bigger, and I think that's part of why this went so viral, is because people are giving up more and more control over their own materials, their own files,
Absolutely.
Their own machines to all these other entities and companies and services.
It's convenient. Why should I worry about it? Put it in the cloud, and I don't have to think about it anymore. Put your photographs, put your recordings, put everything, your memories, put them all there.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of the story from years back when Amazon was deleting the book 1984 from people's devices because it turned out that they weren't allowed to own this version of that book.
So they just removed it as if you never had it, which is, when you think of the book, they're doing that too. Wow, that was, but that's the power that they have now. That's what the kind of thing they can do. We had a problem with one of our issues on Kindle, and basically they replaced the copies that had been sent out in error with the right ones.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that was the right thing to do, but they went and they grabbed what was in people's collections, removed it, and replaced it with something else. An evil person's power, that could be something very bad. You could change the news. You could change history. And this is what we have to think about whenever we use these new forms of technology.
Yeah, I'm fully with that. I really feel like this is a byproduct, a result of more computers, simply more computers being about and on more people, and more services that these computers are working with. And I think it's sort of the generations of things becoming obsolete, having varying versions of things, getting a new device, and then sort of things trying to play nice with each other or replace or supplant another device. You get this with, like TV stuff now. Mm-hmm. Everything is trying to be a TV, whether it's your phone or your smart TV or something you attach to your TV. It's just everything wants to be smart, and they don't always play nice. I guess that's the only way I can really boil it down, but I definitely was getting that in this conversation, and there is more of this to be vigilant regarding and look out for, because we have this stuff, we're integrating this stuff, and it's changing constantly. It can change while we're sleeping and, all of a sudden have a new firmware version when you wake up. It's just all kinds of ramifications.
Yeah, and just to give this sort of power over to something else, especially now this is the music industry in this particular case, and the entertainment industry in general really has, we've watched them kicking and screaming be dragged into the current technical environment where they're still trying to clutch so much control over what people are allowed to do with what they purchase or what they're allowed to watch, what they're licensed to watch. And we're seeing a lot of technical madness come from that.
Yeah, there are absolutely efforts underway to skip this entire generation of keeping music as something you own. The sort of streaming radio services and all of these, as you said, cloud-based things.
It's not just music.
Yep.
It's books. It's video. It's even your cars. You don't own anything anymore. You just lease the right to use them. And it's very unhealthy. We're going to see more and more stories like this, I think. Guys, we are out of time. Can you believe it? 2 hours have just flown by. But we would be very remiss if we did not give out the phone number again and encourage people to keep calling and pledging support for the show. We've had some very interesting conversations tonight. We would not have had those conversations if this station was not here. So if you want the station to remain here, please call 516-620-3602. Say you're calling for Off the Hook. Pledge whatever you can afford. You'll get something nice in return, and you'll keep this place going, keep conversations like this happening. 516-620-3602. And that's going to do it for us tonight. I didn't mean to scare anybody with that.
Really scared.
We'll be back in 2 weeks, I think. We won't be here next week, that's for sure. But we will be reading our email, so oth@2600.com. And don't forget, speaker submissions, you have until Friday, hope.net. You probably have something interesting to talk about, consider it. There's a lot out there in the hacker world. We'll see you whenever we see you, I guess.
And if you haven't got a Hope ticket, get a Hope ticket.
That's
and
right.
And if you
right.
bought one, look out for your Hope ticket because it's probably on the way or you
That's
already
right.
have it in your inbox.
Yes. Well, for Kyle and Rob and Bernie and everybody else, this is Emmanuel. We're Off the Hook. Have a good night.
Good night.